Chuck Green. All three are subjects of the documentary film No Maps on My Taps, which was just shown on Channel 12 about 2 weeks ago on a Sunday night. With me now is Sandman Sims and filmmaker of the film No Maps on My Taps, George Nirenberg. The film will be shown through the weekend at the TLA, and Sims, Briggs, and Green will be performing at the TLA, and this is all part of their Mayfest 80 Performance Arts Festival. For any information about the tickets to the performances or the film, you can call the TLA at 922-6011. I'll be giving that phone number again a little later in our conversation. Welcome, George, Sandman, to Fresh Air. How'd you all meet up? George, why'd you get the idea for this film?
I was down at the Tin Palace in New York, and it happened that Richie Cole was there that night with Eddie Jefferson, the late Eddie Jefferson, and Sandman Sims. Now, I knew nothing about jazz tap dancing. When Sandman came out on that floor, he was a novelty for me. He was a novelty act and a great one. But there was something about it that stuck in the back of my mind. I mean, it was something more than just being a novelty act. There was something very artful to what he was doing. And I could see the history in his steps. There was, it sort of resonated with a quality, a certain rich quality. And a number of months later, somebody mentioned to me black jazz tap dancers. Why not a film about black jazz tap dancers? So I said, I thought back in my mind, Sandman Sims. I'd seen Sandman, and I started investigating it and realized that Sandman was a representative of a history of entertainment that was on its way out. There were only a handful of men left like him that were still dancing like he was dancing. And it was right up in the alley of the kind of films that I'm interested in doing, ones where there's a certain group of people, a person, or that have a statement to make. They have a story to tell, and they have a struggle that they're going through. All they really need is an outlet. An audience that has great value to what they have to say, and it's generally unheard of and unheard from. They're the people that generally in this country are unheard of and are unheard from.
Okay, George, we'll talk some more about the film a little later. Sandman, you started off being interested in boxing, and when I heard that, I said, gee, this has always struck me as being two really different things. Boxing, for which you're supposed to be really muscular, bulging muscles and real tough, and dancing, for which you have to be really limber, and you need muscles, but I always thought of them as muscles of a different sort. Now, how did you make the connection between the two?
Well, see, when I was first born, I was born in a family of dancers. All my family could dance. My mother, my father, my brothers and sisters before me could dance. And I always could dance. I don't know where I got it from. It was just born in me. When I got up off the floor from crawling, I could dance. Instead of walking, I could dance. And I tried to dance in a hurry to catch up with my brothers and sisters. During the time I was a born dancer. It's no lessons or nothing. It was just a gift. I concentrated on being a fighter because everybody used to tease me on the corner about dancing all the time. And I would fight about it because I thought they were ridiculing me. And I made the transition to go in the ring. I got good enough to, you know, fight on the corner, so I went in the ring. And in the ring, they had a box that they had rosin in to keep you from sliding around. And they would make all the young fighters go in this box and get rosin on their feet. Well, when I went to this rosin box, I would go there with the idea of dancing in it. And I'd do a dance in the rosin box, and they seemed to like that better than they did my boxing. And after I broke my hand, I decided that I would revert back to my dancing. But see, I was raised in the gym. I never been to a rehearsal hall too much. I don't believe in rehearsing because my dance is always there. I always try to keep my body in condition. And to me, dancing is like being a fighter. It's competitive. And it's really, you know, it's really an athletic event. It's not just what you say, art, it's a real physical, you know, culture.
But I bet the whole culture surrounding fighting was really different than the culture surrounding tap dancing and music.
Well, you see, here's what happened about the culture around the two of them. I just was so competitive with whatever I did was competitive rubbed off. While I was trying to be a boxer, I was competitive. When I stopped boxing to dance, looked like everybody I meet on the street or anywhere I met a dancer or anything. We would dance just like we was fighting. And it got to be, you know, it's got to be real competitive to where people begin to say, well, we don't care whether you can dance or not. Are you the best? Are you one of the best?
See, that's this whole side of tap dancing that those of us who grew up, like, watching the Ed Sullivan Show never got exposed to. Yeah. Now, I've heard great stories about, like, tenor players and stuff, yes, who after hours would have these great improvisational battles on the stage. But so where would you get together to almost compete with one another?
All right,
with your step?
You said you heard about the tenor saxophone players competing and against each other. Well, we'd either be right outside the door and hearing distance of the horns blowing, or we'd be in the next room or somewhere close to where they were playing, and we would dance to what they were playing, and we would challenge the next guy to do better than we did what they were doing. And this is where the challenge come in. It was a jazz dance that we did to the jazz music.
When you're doing jazz dancing, which has more importance, the sound that you're making or the way your body looks when you're doing it?
Well, here's what it is. I'll have to tell you in another way. It's two. We have two distinctive styles of dancing. We have one style is tap dancing. That's one style itself. Then another style is hoofing. See, tap dancers can tap dance, but all of them can't hoof. But the average hoofer can tap dance. And it's a different style altogether, where a tap dancer uses nothing but the heel and the toe, where the taps are. A hoofer uses the whole foot.
Oh, so I always thought of the two as being pretty synonymous. Guess
no, what? No, it's a whole lot of difference in the execution and everything, the rudiments, the rhythm, the patterns and all. It's a lot of difference.
So you're a hoofer?
I'm both.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm considered both because I developed both. But it's a lot of people just go to school and take up tap dancing. They never know anything about hoofing. And when they see a hoofer, it's all new to them. Like, I've seen tap dancers that come out of dancing schools. The first time they see me dance, they blow their mind. They say, oh, my goodness, what is he doing? The teacher can't even teach this what I'm doing. Because it's not what you count, it's how you feel and what you hear.
I know that some of the big bands used to, I think, have tap dancers, or tap dancers would at least show up for the jam sessions. Was that the case?
Well, those were mostly tap dances, but in the later years it was like hoofing. And
see, I'm not used to using both those words differently.
Well, see, most of the guys, after you turn professional as a tap dancer, you turn professional. Well, when you can say you're a professional, you can hoof, because that's what you're selling. See, because after you leave tap dancing, there's something else out there besides just jumping up and down doing steps. Tap dancing, you said about the body movements. Tap dancing is just a dangerous thing. But hoofing, you use the body, the mind, and everything else. And you don't have time to count. Because if you'll notice those jam sessions you saw, the saxophone players, they didn't have time to read no music. They had to play what come to them. And it's just improvising and perfecting and creating as they go along. But we got to the place where we could do this with our feet to keep up with the saxophone or the drummer.
You said that you never really formally studied dancing, but you knew, like, Bilbo Jangles Robinson.
I knew, yes, I knew all the dancers.
What kind of advice did they give you, or what kind of demonstrations did
they do? Well, here's what would happen with Bilbo Jangles Robinson. It was competitive with him anyway. Whenever you talked Bill Robinson, you was talking about the great dancer, the best dancer. And during the time that he was in his prime, well, it was a lot of dancers that was known, but they never could come to the point to where they could outdo him. And most of the dancers patterned after him up until a certain age. And then after he played out, they had a guy named John Bubbles. And Bucking Bubbles, he was the father of close rhythm. He changed the style of dancing. He put more hoofing into tap dancing than anybody you know. He's the one that started the idea of saying, I'm a hoofer, because Bill Robinson was strictly a tap dancer. And after Bubbles came around, well, you know, just we played on his game like a new guy in the block come up with a new shot playing basketball. We all tried to develop that shot. And by developing Bubbles' style, we left Bill's style behind, but we could do the same. We could tap dance. See, that's the first thing you have to learn is time, and time is nothing but a tap dance. So after we learned time, we just exploited it and did everything we want to with it, do anything you want to with it.
In the film, which I saw and enjoyed I think you mentioned that Bill Robinson suggested to you that yes, you should have a gimmick. And
I had been tapping so long till I wanted something else, and I had perfected this sound, but I never paid any mind. I never paid any attention to it. And like I'd get into a real tough challenge on the street, I'd always revert back to my sand, and I would do it in a tap dancing style. And I couldn't do it in a huffing style because it was too strenuous, but I'd do it in a tap dancing style, and this would always, you know, take the other guy by surprise and knock him right out of the box. So I was doing it, and Bill Robinson saw me, and he says, says, that's a great thing you're doing. He says, you should keep that up. He said, because that's a good gimmick. Develop it and do everything you can with it, because I have a gimmick, and that's what keeps him going, is that dancing up and down the stairs. He says, I developed that. I can do it any kind of way I want to, and everybody respects this, and when you put this on somebody, they'll know what you do. So I developed my sand dance, and throughout my travels, I come around and I get more, you know, and lighting on it. And the dancing board that I'm on now is about 35 years old. See, I developed a board after I developed a dance.
So was he right? Was it useful yes. to have that kind of trademark?
Yes, well, I have that trademark. And I've had noticed time when I go to somewhere to work, they'd always tell me in advance, if you don't bring the sand board with you, you can stay home. This was my moniker, and all through the rock and roll area where it was hard for a tap dancer to work because the music was too loud and you couldn't hear the taps, they would always settle down for my sand. Yeah, I could always work with my sand, and I worked all the way through that area. I never laid off, you know, like most tap dancers, they didn't get much work.
What kind of audiences were you playing for?
Same audiences playing rock and roll audiences. Yeah, I even changed my name to the Rock and Roll Sandman.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I had that going for a while and got me a lot of work.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah, you have to have gimmicks and, you know, little things that'll keep you working. You have to have something to sell.
So you'd be dancing while one of the groups was performing?
Yeah, well, no, I'd be dancing in between the groups, yes. Or I would come on when they have just a musical bit of the act. They sing and then they play the instruments. I would come in and add that extra, like a shaker. But I would be doing the sand. And sanding is only using the brushes on a drum instead of the sticks. We had a great drummer named Sid Catlett.
Yeah.
Well, he's the one person in my life that motivated me and enlightened me on sanding. He took the brushes, and he would say, do this with your feet. And I'd have to do that with my feet. And then I would say, well, you do this one with your brushes. And we exchange ideas, and he really helped me perfect it.
Were many drummers interested in what you as a dancer could do percussively?
Well, I'll tell you what the real thing is. Most dancers wants to be drummers and fighters, and most fighters want to be drummers and dancers, and most drummers want to be fighters and dancers. It's the same rhythm. It's like I can take my hands and do steps up there, and then I'll take my feet and do the same step. Well, a drummer's the same way. I've been challenged by drummers that you had to set in with your 2 feet, and they set in with a drum, and I try to outdo them. And so you have a set of drums you're walking on around every day.
Right.
Your heel is the bass drum, your toes is the sticks, and the ball of your foot is the tom-tom, and your cymbals is the snare out on the side when you scrape your feet, and your brushes, you can do the sand for the brushes, and it's all rhythm, you know, and it's just running through rudiments, paradiddles.
Sam, did you ever get a chance to meet Baby Lawrence?
I was brought up and say in my later years with Baby Lawrence. That was mostly my main challenge. We challenge every day.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, we challenge every day because we was only about 8 blocks apart. Like, yeah, I lived at 123rd and he lived at 118th. And it's right down the street from me. And when I'd get up, either I'd go looking for him or he'd come looking for me. And it was like two kids in the neighborhood. They, you know, fighting to see who the best was.
I thought that we could just take out a minute and listen to a short selection from Baby Lawrence record. Now, this is Baby Lawrence, and the piece is called The Sand, and he's dancing in sand in this. So maybe we could just listen to a minute of this, and maybe you can tell us a little bit about what you think is happening that's making the sounds that we're hearing.
Thank you.
Yes, a recording by Baby Lawrence, who is a jazz dancer. My special guest now is Sandman Sims, and who has his name Sandman from Dancing in the Sand. That's his specialty. What'd you think of that, Sandman?
Well, the only thing I can say about this is he got his lessons well. If you come out to the show tonight, I'll show you where he got it from. And that's the first time I heard him on a record doing the sand, but I've seen him try to do it because I've, you know, it's been showing him a lot. And I didn't think he was that much interested in it. And he never told me that he went off and made a record.
Oh, really?
Yes.
So he learned that from you?
Yeah, sure. I was the first one who did it. I mean, I came to New York as a Sandman. And he was one of my first challenges as a tap dancer. See, I never had no challenges but one in a sand dance. And that was a boy named Eddie Waller. That was Fats Waller's grandson. And when I came to New York, he was supposed to be a Sandman. So they put us on the stage and they put up the money and everything, and then we went to work, so they christened me the Sandman after it was over. And he's a bartender now. And I had begun to challenge Baby Lawrence, but I didn't know he was taking sand that serious, because he never act like he wanted to do it. But he, you know, since he's passed, I've been finding a lot of things that he's a great dancer.
What's the kind of music that you most enjoy dancing to?
All music.
Mm-hmm.
Any music. It don't make any difference what kind it is. What it really boils down to is if you are setting up and you hear music and you don't pick no specific music, whatever music I hear, I'll sit there in a chair and do a dance to it. Just listening to it, I'll sit there and do a dance to it. That's any kind of music. And it don't make any difference because there's so many different rhythms and everything that you get tired of doing the same thing over and over. So every time I hear a different tune, I do a different dance.
Have you seen yourself on film before No Maps and My Taps was completed?
Once or twice, but not really in stride like this.
What did you think watching the movie, getting to see yourself?
No Maps and My Taps?
Yeah.
I never thought that I was as good as I should have been. I always, you know... I saw some spots where I could have been better, and I saw some spots where I could have relaxed more, and by not being experienced to it, I saw a lot of faults. I wasn't looking for how good I was. I was looking for what I didn't do or what I missed or what I could have filled in, and that's always a challenge with me. I've never been on the floor where I come off and said, I really did my best, because I've never had a chance to do this.
So you'd recommend to other dancers maybe that they get to see themselves on tape or on film
for
feedback?
And the greatest thing in the world is to rehearse in front of your audience. To be able to rehearse in front of your audience. This is where you see what they want or what they'll go for or what they won't go for. But you got to be clever enough to put it over and not let them know it's a rehearsal. Each show is a rehearsal.
Got it.
Yeah, that's the way I figured.
Sam, let me reintroduce George this conversation. George, what are some of the things that you found out about dancing that you weren't prepared for, things that really surprised you?
Well, tap dancing is an extremely versatile art form. There's many different types of tap dancing. This, as Sandman mentioned, this is sand dancing, there's acrobatic tap dancing, there's ballroom tap dancing, there's ballet tap dancing, there's novelty tap, comedy tap. And these are different areas of tap dancing and hoofing that were developed primarily by black people and white people. Fred Astaire, of course, did much more ballroom type of tap. And meeting these guys, I mean, they're historical figures and they're national treasures. And in many respects, they're also national heroes because they've stuck with it. They've kept it going. Sandman's generation is the protégés of people like Bill Robinson and people like John Bubbles. Unfortunately, there aren't the kind of protégés that like they were to Bill Robinson and John Bubbles. They don't have those sorts of protégés.
You don't, Sandman?
He's shaking his head.
Yeah, shaking his head.
No.
I'm kind of surprised at this one, just because I know people who are strictly as amateurs with no sense of performance are taking lessons just because they like it so much. So I figured, well, if my friends who are long past the stage where they're going to become a professional are doing it, there must be a lot of younger people.
Here's what I think George is trying to say. If you're not maybe, say, 25, 30, 35, or 40, you've never seen a real tap dancer.
Mm-hmm.
But how's a tap dancer going to make a living today anyway? I mean, you know, they pass on the art form, but there's got to be an outlet. In those days, there were clubs.
They're only taken from a school standpoint. It's a commercial.
Right.
It's not from the real art. That's when they said tap dancing is a lost art. tap dancing is not a lost art. People just lost the art. Tap dancing will never die. And what happened, so happened that they didn't think that the style of dancing that we are doing today, the hoofers, that were still around, because they thought after Bill Robertson and John Bubbles and Fred Astaire and Gene Kelly and them went off the tubes, everybody quit doing it. But we went underground, and we became more vicious with it then, because they were, you know, pushing it off of the face of the music sheet. They wouldn't even think about a tap dancer, you know, and we just kept doing it till we could make some noise so somebody could hear it.
Mm-hmm. What do you think of the Hollywood-oriented tap dancers like Fred Astaire and Gene Kelly?
Well, I give them credit for one thing. They kept people's mind on dancing. They kept it going. They were school dancers. They got theirs from John Bubbles, and where we all got ours from. And they came in, and he taught them more so than he would us, the blacks, because he was getting paid from them, and he was challenging us. It was more like a duel. And he was giving it to them so they could, you know, exploit it. But I think it was a great thing in what he did when he showed it to them so they could take it on the tubes and keep it alive as long as they did, to somebody else could come along and pick it up. Because after they played out, now this is where we came in. They don't have any more dancers. They don't have any more people that could step out like Fred Astaire, Gene Kelly, or Ann Miller still going, but not as strong as she was. And Ruby Keeler. I can name them, Eleanor Powell, Donald O'Connor, Fred Murray, McMurray, and Hal Leroy, all those kind of fellas that was keeping dancing out there till somebody could get a hold to it that could really show it and get it back on the basis like you'd see a comedian, or you see a singer, or you see a saxophone player, a guitar player. Everybody had their day but a dancer. And it, the reason it was because they was all dying out and nobody was putting nothing back or filling in.
So is there a street life for dancers now, you know, a place outside of the performance stage where you can meet other dancers and challenge each other?
No, this is what we call in New York the sunny side of the street, asphalt jungles, where the sidewalk ends. This is where we all meet. And in a certain time, we have, you know, different streets we meet on. And our type of dancing is the street dancing. It is a street. It's not from a school. It's the street dancing. And the reason it goes over so good on the stage, because we are used to performing right in the street where people see it, you know. And we don't wait till they pass the test in the schools so we can be promoted, so we can be on the show this week and go on the stage. We are on the stage all the time. So it's not any hard job for us to get on the stage and dance.
Now that people are knowing you not only through your stage performances, mm-hmm. but through this film, which is getting a lot of play. It was on public television here in Philadelphia, and I know it's been shown in many cities in screenings and movie houses as it will be shown at the TLA. Do you find that your audiences are broadening now?
Yes. How did you enjoy it?
Oh, I enjoyed it.
Well, I'm going to tell you what really happened. Anytime you take time out and give a lecture demonstration, let them see what and hear what and tell them about what they've seen, they will enjoy it more because they understand it more. But how can you understand anything you enjoy anything that you don't understand? Mm-hmm. And the way we were dancing, we were doing so many taps and so many variations of taps, they didn't understand. And it was like this all the time that after, say, the Giants left, the Common Warriors would be dancing, they couldn't understand them because they didn't have the you know, opportunity to show what they could really do. They just say, oh, get out of here with that noise.
George, how is this film affecting your career as a filmmaker?
Well, the film is done very, very well, and it's getting a lot of exposure. And the interesting thing about it is we've put together a package where the film is the first part of the show. And in that way, people can understand the dancers. They understand them because they learn about them. And then when the dancers come out on the stage and perform live after it, it's like having ice cream on apple pie. It's a real treat, and it's a historical moment. So that sort of exposure is very gratifying, and I'm going on to a film on gospel music, and I'll also be doing another film on tap dancing, which will be more of a created work, like in an old Hollywood musical. Mm-hmm. But I'd say that the film has done great things for my career, and it's what can I say?
Great. Well, wish you both the best, and if you are interested in seeing these tap performances following the movie No Maps on My Taps, this is going to be happening throughout the weekend.
Right, three times on Saturday, three times on Sunday, two on Monday evening, and two on Tuesday evening, and it's a very, very exciting show, and I can guarantee anybody that comes will enjoy it very, very much.
Well, I'm going to give you the phone number if you'd like to call for any information, and this is at the TLA Theater on South Street, And the phone number to call is 922-6011. If you'd like any more information about the live tap performances that will include my guest Sandman Sims and the film No Maps on My Taps, again, that's 922-6011. Well, we're about out of time now. Sandman Sims, George Nierenberg, thanks so much for coming.
I just do want to mention one thing, that the National Endowment for the Arts was very, very helpful in making this film, and if it wasn't for them, this films like mine would never get to be made.
Okay. Well, momentarily, we're going to be joining Tia O'Brien live from Temple University, where President Carter...
I have but one thing left to say.
What?
Come on out. I'm going to dance for you.
Okay. We'll be joining Tia O'Brien, who will be anchoring the live broadcast with President Carter at the town meeting that he will be holding in just about 60 seconds. The town meeting is expected to last about an hour, so when we return to the studios, which will probably be about 4 o'clock, Bill Van Wert, Fresh Air's film reviewer, will be with us, and he'll be reviewing the film Where the Buffalo Roam, and Bill Murray of Saturday Night Live stars in the role of Hunter Thompson, the gonzo journalist in this film. He'll be reviewing that at about 4. Then at about 4:30, we'll hear from Haynes Johnson, who's a political reporter for The Washington Post, and also an analyst on Washington Week in Review, which is featured on public television. He's written a new book about the office of the presidency, and that's what he'll be discussing at about 4:30 this afternoon on Fresh Air. My name is Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air on WUHY-FM in Philadelphia. And in just a moment, we will be joining Tia O'Brien live from Temple University, where President Carter's town meeting is expected to begin in just about 2 minutes. I hope you can stay tuned with us. This is WUHY-FM in Philadelphia. We're listener-supported public radio in the Delaware Valley.
Thank you very much, Terry. This is Tia O'Brien. We are broadcasting live on WUHY this afternoon from McGonagall Hall on the Temple University campus. We are awaiting the start of the town meeting, which will get underway promptly at 3 p.m. The president arrived in Philadelphia shortly after noon at the Naval Base. This is the president's first trip back to Philadelphia since 1976. At 1 p.m., he addressed the local World Affairs Council, and now the town meeting should be getting underway. Philadelphia Mayor Bill Green